The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world, and we kind of reflect on what's going on in our world from the perspective of our Catholic moral values, our teachings, our beliefs. And we call our show Just Love because while we strive to, as a people, make our world more just and we try to make it more compassionate, if we just love, if we just love God, if we just love ourselves, if we just love our neighbor, if we all did that, our world would be just and it would be compassionate. So just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, one of those interesting pieces of the reality of the United States as being such a big country is there are all these different jurisdictions. And I know most of us know kind of there's a federal level, a federal system of government, and you got the national government in Washington, D.C. And probably most people know that wasn't where the Capitol always was, although it's been there for most of the history of the United States as a country. And they know about their state government, and we know about local government, and sometimes we even know there's different things within our local governments. There are school districts and water districts and all of those type of things. But probably fewer people know that there are parts of the United States that aren't states. There are territories, there are commonwealths. They have different relationships to the United States. And one of those that is currently in the middle of a terrible financial crisis is Puerto Rico. And it's been kind of unfolding over the past decades. And so governments always buy bonds and they always take on debt in order to finance projects. And now what's coming true in Puerto Rico in a month or so is that it seems all the projections are saying that there's about $2 billion that has to be paid on that debt, on bonds, and there's not going to be the money to pay it. And that creates a real, real problem. So there's been a lot of discussion as to what do we deal with it, because it's not a state. It doesn't have some of the protections that states have, and it's precluded from doing certain things. So there's a lot of proposals as to how to do something with that. So kind of today we're going to focus on Puerto Rico, two points of view. First, we're going to learn about a heroic Puerto Rican regiment who fought for the United States during the two world wars and the Korean War. And last month, this regiment was awarded the prestigious Gold Medal of Honor by Congress. And so we'll learn a little bit about that history, because sometimes the history of this country, sadly, has been that we haven't always included all the groups in the country, and we've excluded them. There is a history of prejudice, discrimination, racism in a lot of ways, and sometimes that has had very, very difficult and negative impact in various ways. And sometimes you have to do things in order to recognize that past, in order to move forward. So we're going to speak about that. And then a little bit later on, we're going to speak to somebody who knows a lot about the situation in Puerto Rico as the pastor of the Archdiocese of San Juan, the Archbishop there, Roberto Gonzalez. And I would consider Archbishop Gonzalez somebody whom I knew when he was working here in New York many years ago. And I'm delighted that he's agreed to speak to us about the situation in Puerto Rico as a country. We kind of deal with some legislation to maybe try to deal with the debt crisis that is there. Tom, I think, why don't we go to our first guest? Our first guest is Samuel Rodriguez, who is the national chair of the Boricuas Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony Committee, and he has been very, very active in this movement. And I'm delighted that Samuel Rodriguez has agreed to be a guest with us on Just Love today. Samuel Rodriguez, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Monsignor. It's always a pleasure to be here and to support your program and to talk about
So, okay, say it for me again. Say it for me again so I maybe can try to get it right.
Borinqueneers. Borinqueneers.
Okay, Borinqueneers. Like, almost like pioneers, but Borinqueneers.
Actually, it's a mixed word between the native name of Puerto Rico and the buccaneers, who were pirates that were, they used to sail in the seas of the Gulf of Mexico back in the day when we had pirates guarding our coast.
Maybe I shouldn't kind of say this, but there's something about pirates. I know they're kind of bad guys, but there's something about them that I always found kind of alluring and attractive about pirates. They seem to have kind of an exciting life, didn't they?
Yeah, well, it's amazingly to say that the pirates used to be deputized by the United States back when the British tried to invade the country. It was pirates who were our first line of defense in terms of our homeland and our shores. So, you know, pirates can be looked at in two ways, but for sure they were used in the defense of the United States when the United States was a brand new colony.
You know, to get a little bit serious for a moment. In fact, it's not pirates, but we're still hiring private security firms and companies to deal with security in some pretty dangerous parts of the world. For whatever reason, we find that a solution that maybe is politically more palatable than putting more military troops in certain places in the Middle East.
I'm just saying. So it did happen. So anyway, that's how when the Bolivian leaders were assigned the mission to go to Korea, on their way to Korea through the Gulf of Panama Canal, that's when they came up with the Borinqueneer, which is a battle name that they used largely and publicly in the Korean War. And that's how the name came about.
Okay.
And it became a lot of prominence.
So how...
They
were active in a number of wars, right?
Yes. This year, as we begin to celebrate the 100th year of the World War One, it was the Borinqueneers, which is the army militia that was already organized in Puerto Rico after the Spanish-American War. The first shots of the United States in the First World War were shot out of Puerto Rico, and when the German vessel was trying to leave the bay, and we shot at them because they didn't have any clearance, because they were actually going to supply one of the U-boats. So the first shots of the World War One in the United States were shot from Puerto Rico. Then 2 years later, the United States declared war in Germany. So that's why the Borinqueneers, which is the unit that held for Puerto Rico, that's why when we organized the Congressional Gold Medal and when we organized the design of the medal, we included World War One, World War Two, and Korea. It's the only segregated unit in the history of the United States that participated in all three conflicts.
Huh.
So that's a historical thing. Yes, sir.
That is interesting. So it's that group, the 65th Infantry Regiment. So they kind of fired the first shot of World War One
from the United States. That's correct, sir. Out of El Morro. I'm sure that when you went to El Morro, you didn't hear that. But if you do a search and even the World War Two centennial commission is already recognizing the participation of the Borinqueneers in World War One. And after the Jones Act, right after the Jones Act was signed into law, the Borinqueneers were put on a ship and sailed off to guard the Panama Canal. As soon as World War One ended, the Borinqueneers received the World War One Victory Medal for their participation in World War One, and then in World War Two, and then in Korea.
We're speaking with Sam Rodriguez, who is the national chair of the Borinqueneers Congressional Gold Medal Committee, and we're speaking about the history of this very, very kind of elite regiment that was actually a segregated regiment. So give our listeners a little sense, because that doesn't make a lot of sense to us today. But we know the history of this country, unfortunately, has a fair amount of prejudice and discrimination. So how did these segregated regiments come to be?
Well, it really was not set as a you're going to be a segregated unit. It was just that they were organized and formed in Puerto Rico to guard the island. Okay? Ah. So they were formed, but they were mainly composed of enlisted and officers, and most of the enlisted were from Puerto Rico. And the unit did a lot of civic, a lot of community activism in the island, because it was like the first, you know, it was like the sponsored by the United States Congress, and so they were formed. But that unit stayed together like that, and the first time the first insignia of the unit had the eagle with the lion, and then later on it was changed to the insignia of the eagle with the Lamb of God on top of the eagle. So it's very, very, it's a unit that was very, very central to Puerto Rican culture. And when World War II came, there was still a lot of prejudice towards the unit. And here in Washington, they used to call the 65th Infantry the rum and coke outfit.
Ah.
And they would ridicule them and make fun of them. But during World War II, they went to World War II to fight the Nazi or a battalion, and they earned a lot of medals. But it didn't happen until the Korean crisis, like a month or 2 months before the Korean crisis, that they were doing some maneuvers. And they did some maneuvers in Vieques. And the maneuvers were that the unit was the aggressive unit, and the 3rd Infantry Division would come to liberate the unit. And it just so happens that the unit was so well entrenched and trained and motivated that the 3rd Infantry could not get through and basically lost the battle of the exercise. That's what the exercise they called a sport trick. So shortly after that, when the order came down, within June, in June of 1950, the Department of the Army commissioned the 65th for their readiness, and they ordered them into battle to go to Korea when the Korean War is in battle. And the 65th went to Korea, and they stayed in the theater of war for the entire campaign. From 1950 to 1953, and that's pretty remarkable, because most units never stayed for an entire war. They just rotate after a year or 15 months. But the Borinquen is a command stayed in Korea from the beginning to the end, to the very end, and they earned thousands of medals, and they had some of the roughest battles. The entire Marine division could have been slaughtered had it not been for the Borinqueneers, and they were used in a lot of military units and missions, and so on and so forth. So, you know, to many people, the Korean War is like the forgotten war, except for Puerto Ricans, because they fought every day while the war was on.
How big's the regiment? I don't know anything about kind of these military things, divisions, regiments, troops, etc.
Okay.
How many people in a regiment?
Well, in the regiment back then, the regiments, and they were, of course, they were formed during World War One, and the cavalry or the hikers, and that's why they get the regiment, because they used to be mounted military. But the numbers that they have, the full strength unit is 5,000 and below. So, you know, that's what you have a regiment. In a division, to these days, you have 10,000 troops form what they have a division. But back then, 5,000 and below was a pretty, that's a strong element of military people. And that regiment was really stretched out throughout the entire Korean Peninsula. I mean, and they were so good. They did so much well because, as a matter of fact, because they were segregated, and that wasn't that they were segregated, it's just that they were a unit that fought together, just like the Tuskegee and the other, the Nisei, the Mumford Marine, the other racially segregated units. And the Portuguese just happened to be in that situation themselves and find themselves to be a segregated unit. Then in the middle of the war, towards the second part of the war, the President Eisenhower, the President of the time,
Truman?
Truman, Harry Truman, he decided to integrate the unit. And when he integrated the unit with NCOs from all over the United States, that's when all hell broke loose, because... Well, the thing is that the NCOs and officers that came to command the unit did not know Spanish, so they could not communicate with NCOs, and they could not communicate. And when you have a communication breakdown, it becomes chaotic, especially in battle. It was like no training. Here's the new command, and okay, go follow that. Follow him, and go after that mountain and chop it down. It doesn't work that way. Come at a totally different situation.
So, Sam, let's move on a little bit. I mean, you said the unit. You know, a lot of people in the various wars, they got individual medals and they were recognized for their fighting, their valor, their honor, their patriotism. So, but tell us a little bit about the significance of the unit getting the Congressional Gold Medal of Honor.
Well, the significance of the unit is that, number one, it was the only predominantly Hispanic unit that was active during all world wars, all global wars of the 20th century. Number two, it was the last unit to do a full military assault, hand-to-hand combat with bayonets, fixed bayonets in the war. So these days, when they are giving out the Congressional Gold Medal to various units, you have a Hispanic unit that originated from Puerto Rico. And as we all know, Puerto Rico doesn't get nearly the same treatment that many states get. So it's very significant because the United States did not have a Hispanic unit that did that on the state side. So being that there was a territory and they were put in a position of infantry, which is very difficult, it's very significant because there's no other infantry unit that has done this in the history of the United States military. So that's very significant. So when this happened, Congress saw this and said, wait a minute, we have a problem here. We've treated this unit wrong, and now we're going to correct it. So when we led the effort to get the co-sponsors, we did that in 1 year without any funding. We just did it from ourselves and through Facebook and volunteers across the nation. We combined, we got together, and we just made it happen. I mean, just to tell you, I had to organize a nonprofit just to be able to generate revenue to buy the replica medals to give to the soldiers. So you can understand the challenges of starting from an idea into having a very successful ceremony in Washington D.C. was a daunting challenge for us.
So who's got the medal actually?
Well, the medal is kept by the Smithsonian. But it's kept by the Smithsonian for research and historical tours, and we were able to give replicas, and we're still giving out replicas to the living Borinqueneers because our census is about that. We still have 1,000 living Borinqueneers across the nation because we also have Borinqueneers that were attached to the unit from, let's say, Illinois, Kansas City, Washington, California, and we have built that kind of a business model. That if they were assigned to the unit, then we are trying to raise funds and awareness to give them replicas of these medals. So it's a big honor for us, and we had a very successful ceremony and very, very heartfelt and a lot of tears. A lot of tears because despite the treatment that we're seeing today here in Washington, Puerto Rican people are very patriotic and pro United States. We have done it all. So it's not like we just showed up. No, we've paid our dues hard fought. I mean, we lost a lot of POWs. I mean, if people think about MASH really was started during the Korean War. This is such a casualty. So the human sacrifice dues have been done, have been paid for in the Korean War. So
well, you know, Sam, when you talk about, I'm from New York, and one of the things that we know in New York that our whole New York scene has been so enriched by those who have moved from Puerto Rico to New York many, many years ago, first settling in a part of New York City that is called East Harlem or El Barrio, and that became such a vibrant place of life, industrialness, etc. So I am just really, really delighted that our nation has recognized the contribution of the Borinqueneers in contributing to the country, their patriotism, their valor in kind of defending this nation.
Yeah, And it is. And I mean, I was born in the Bronx,
so was I.
I told everybody I'm a real Yankee, and I say it with pride. And
yeah,
I'm,
but hold on for a second. But Sam, we ain't doing too well this year. The Yankees aren't doing too well.
Well, I don't care. They could be all and nothing, but I'm still going to be a Yankee because Yankees is just part of Americana. And you see, a lot of Mets fans, a lot of Yankees fans, but the majority of the Puerto Rican community, they love their Yankees fans.
Well, I mean, I've always felt that community has exquisite taste, which is indicated by the team they root for. I mean, the Yankees are the major league professional team in New York. I mean, that's who you root for. We've had a few rough years, but, you know, we got 27 World Series. So, I mean, that's pretty good.
Yes, sir. And I can't tell you that it's been one of the best things. I'm here for me in Washington, and I always tell you, I'm a New Yorker. I'm from the Bronx, so I make no excuses, and I'm very, very proud of my heritage.
Now, the one real claim to fame of the Bronx, in addition to the Yankees, it's the only part of New York City that is connected to the mainland of the United States. Everything else is an island.
I'm just saying.
All right. Hey, Sam Rodriguez, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love and kind of sharing with our listeners the accomplishments, the achievements, and finally, the recognition of the Boricuania. So thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
God bless you, and thank you for inviting me, and have a great day.
Great.
I'm sure it's going to be a lot of fun. Thank you, sir.
Sam Rodriguez is the national chair of the Boricuania's Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony National Committee and worked hard to make sure that the Boricuania's, an infantry regiment, the 65th, was recognized for their valor in multiple wars. I'm on Senior Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We're going to take a break, and join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love, Just Do It. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just, it will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. And this week we're focusing on Puerto Rico, a very interesting part of the United States. It is not a state. It is not independent. It is a territory. I believe it's oftentimes referred to as the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. Actually, it's a commonwealth, rather, not a territory. I've got to clarify that. And it enjoys certain unique or disenjoys certain unique differences in the way that its citizens and some of the way that it can organize itself, some of the fiscal ways that it deals with life there and taxes. But it's one of those places that is, you know, so close to the United States. It's in the Atlantic Ocean, and it has had a fair number of its people, its residents who have moved to the United States. Current time, there's a great deal of economic distress there. And our next guest in a few minutes, Archbishop Roberto Gonzalez, the Archbishop of San Juan, Puerto Rico, has been the pastor there for a number of years. And so we're going to speak with him about the economic crisis that's there and how it's affecting the people who are there. But before we do that, Tom, there's some news that we're going to share with our listeners.
There is, Monsignor. You know, just a couple of things. Actually, we have a anniversary, interestingly enough, Monsignor. We have last week on May 18th, the Catholic social doctrine, in a sense, turned 125 years old because it was the 125th anniversary of the publication by Pope Leo XIII of Rerum Novarum, which, of course, was a seminal encyclical of the Papal Magisterium on questions about the dignity, work, and rights of workers and on the requirements of social justice thereof. So we just want to give a shout out to Catholic social teaching and to Rerum Novarum. We still today, Monsignor, are still concerned about the dignity, work, and rights of workers. And in fact, some other news that wound up coming up, as you may be aware, and I think you were actually there, Monsignor, on Saturday the 21st, Cardinal Dolan joined protesters who were marching through New York City to demand collective bargaining rights for New York State farm workers. He basically was part of the March for Farm Workers Justice. It marched across the Brooklyn Bridge and through the city streets and will eventually start out in Long Island, will eventually end up in Albany on June 1st. And what these marchers are calling for is they're calling for the passage of the Farm Workers Fair Labor Practices Act here in New York that, among other things, will grant largely immigrant workforce that harvests our crops and our livestock in the state the right to overtime pay, to a day's rest, to the right to collectively bargain, and to improve the conditions within which they work.
Tom, I think you're right. I was at that march across the Brooklyn Bridge, and the Brooklyn Bridge, for those who are not in New York, is that bridge, the first bridge that actually connected two parts of New York City when they weren't, in fact, even the same city. It connected the city of Manhattan or New York with the city of Brooklyn. And actually, they had a contest, just for a little bit of background, they had a contest and they had two crews. One began on the Manhattan side, the other on the Brooklyn side. And my understanding is whichever team got to finish its half first, they got to name the bridge. So the Brooklyn team won and they got to call it the Brooklyn Bridge. So that's a little bit of kind of New York history for that. And we walked across it with a number of farm workers and their supporters. And this is very, very simple. Very, very simple. And I think it does tie in what Tom mentioned about this time of year is when that first encyclical, that first letter of Pope Leo XIII was written, in which he kind of reflected on what was going on in the world from the perspective of our values and our Catholic Christian values. And one of the things that he felt was going on, and he wrote a lot about in that, was the fact that the new way of kind of working things out, so the Industrial Revolution, which created a lot of factories, it put a lot of pressure on workers. And there was a lot of pressure then to get as much work as you could out of the workers, not worry so much about safety issues, not worry about how hard they worked, not worried about the conditions in the factory, but just to get as much work as you can, because the competition was to produce as many products as you could. And so the reflection basically of that first encyclical going back 125 years basically said, okay, we believe the human person is made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore that human person merits and deserves some dignity. And that dignity applies where that person works. And so work has always been a focal point of our Catholic perspective on how the world should be ordered correctly, that the work relationships are critically important, just as the family relationships are critically important. But now we're talking about those work relationships. So let me jump forward to not 125 years ago, but just last week. And why are we concerned about the farm workers' fair labor rights and acts here in New York State? Well, it's interesting. I think for our listeners throughout the country, they may say, hey, New York State, it's got all that concrete and asphalt, those big buildings. But in fact, New York State is a major agricultural state. In, I don't know, Tom, do you know which number it is in the world?
I know last year, Monsignor, it was a $6 billion.
Yeah, but you know which, where it ranks in the country?
Oh, I don't know where it ranks.
It's pretty high. I mean, California is obviously the first, and there are some of those Midwest states, but there are a lot. And as Tom said, it was a $6
billion
industry. So there's a lot of farm work. So here's the issue. And so the issue is, as Tom succinctly put it, is that for some reason we have these fair standards throughout the country which say that, you know, if you work more than 40 hours a week, you can work more than 40 hours a week and your boss can ask you to work more than 40 hours a week. But if you do, then you're supposed to be paid time and a half, overtime for that. Also, there are supposed to be some conditions in which you get a day off and things of that nature. But the overtime, let me focus on that for a moment. And so, but in New York State and throughout the country, their farm workers are included in that. We got a law, but they were written out of the law. So the law exempts them from the overtime provision. So there are other things, but this particular law that we're trying to pass here in New York State is saying, hey, wait a minute. The dignity of work says for workers all the places, if they work more than 40 hours, they get time and a half. So why don't we make farm workers included there? And that's what this fight is primarily about. And ironically, the reason why the farm workers were left out when this was passed sometime in the 1930s, it was in the horse training that goes on in politics, that some states want certain things for their states, other states want other things. And basically, in order to get this passed for almost all of the workers in the country, that they had to make a compromise. And some of the people from the southern states says, hey, this is going to hurt us. We don't want this. So if you leave out farm workers and you leave out domestic workers, we'll pass the piece of legislation so everybody else gets overtime. And they decided on the compromise. They said, all right, we're going to get almost all the workers, but not the farm workers, not the domestic workers. And so we're going to pass it. And so to this day, 75 years later or so, that's why farm workers don't have the right to overtime. And that's why we're marching for it. That's why Cardinal Dolan marched for it, just to do the simple thing, to reflect a decent salary for them that reflects, if they put in long hours, they get paid time and a half as all the other workers in America. So again, that's a good, simple, I think, reflection on how, from our Catholic perspective, we try to make sure that the value, the dignity of the person is reflected in the work that we do. So I talked too long. So why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we'll speak with Archbishop Gonzalez about the situation in Puerto Rico. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
De contento con su cargamento para la ciudad, ay, para la ciudad.
Welcome back to Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, and just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, and this is our weekly conversation in which we reflect on our Catholic Christian values and how they impact on things in the world. And we speak with those people who are involved in those issues that try to create a more just and a more compassionate society. And this week we're focusing on Puerto Rico, one of those really, really important parts of the United States, but it's not a state, it's a commonwealth, and therefore there are certain there's a uniqueness to some of its structures and some of what it can do with its fiscal responsibilities and its taxes that don't apply to the states. And at the current time, there is a economic crisis there, and the debt, all states have debt, the United States has debt, and you got to pay that debt back. But there's a crisis coming because, you know, the best estimate is that within a month or so, unless something's done, there might be a default on $2 billion of payments, and that creates all types of problems. So I am incredibly pleased and delighted that the Archbishop of San Juan, Puerto Rico, Roberto Gonzalez, has agreed to take time out of his very, very busy schedule to speak to us about that situation. And in terms of full disclosure, I need to tell our listeners I have been a fan and impressed by Archbishop Gonzalez's work from that time when he was working in the Archdiocese of New York here, spending a lot of time in the South Bronx and doing some very, very important academic work, understanding the what were going on with Hispanics in the United States. So, Archbishop Gonzalez, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today on Just Love.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you, and to Kevin for your invitation, the thoughtfulness, and the solidarity, you know, with Puerto Rico during a very difficult historical moment.
So what I would like to do, and I mean, obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about the legislation. We're going to talk about what needs to be done. From your perspective as the pastor of San Juan, how is the current economic crisis impacting the people of Puerto Rico?
Well, in a variety of ways. First of all, a lot of the pharmaceutical factories have begun to close over the past several years, and thousands of jobs have been lost. There had been a tax provision legislated in the 80s, I believe it was, that permitted companies outside of Puerto Rico to develop their enterprises in Puerto Rico and avoid paying certain taxes. So that might be another question to be debated, but it gave thousands and thousands of Puerto Ricans employment. And fairly well remunerated employment. As a consequence, over the past 10 years, nearly, not quite, nearly a million Puerto Ricans have had to leave Puerto Rico seeking for employment. Most of those have gone to the States, and most of those have gone to Florida. And it's kind of reminiscent of that earlier wave of immigrants from Puerto Rico in the late 40s, 50s, 60s. And as you may recall, hundreds of thousands, millions went to like New York City, Chicago, and other parts of the state. This has a multiplying effect. In the past 3-4 years, the government has closed more than 200 public schools. In recent weeks, some hospitals have begun to close wards. We would say pisos in Spanish. 2 years ago, there were 400 cardiologists in Puerto Rico. Today, there are 200. Last year, 500 doctors left the island in search of, you know, better employment for themselves, or lack of employment in Puerto Rico, and there have been thousands of nurses who have left the island. So it has a multiplying effect, and it's the impact is being felt more and more on the very basic.
I think we have lost Archbishop Gonzalez. We'll try to get him back. He was, you know, talking to us about the devastating effect that it has had on some of the infrastructure of Puerto Rico, that, you know, doctors are leaving the island, that floors of hospitals are closing because they can't afford to stay open, and the outflow of hundreds of thousands, and he says maybe almost up to a million, that have left Puerto Rico in the past decade or so and pretty much have made their way to the United States, many of them settling in the Florida area. And I think from somebody else told me, a lot of Puerto Ricans have moved to the area in Tampa, around Tampa. And so, you know, there are tremendous implications of that. And that's what we're debating now in Congress, because there is legislation now in Congress which is trying to provide a way for Puerto Rico to, you know, get its feet back on the ground and to deal with the looming debt default in about a month or so, to try to figure out, is there a way to deal with that so that they can move forward? And it's always one of those very, very difficult situations. Clearly, the church in the United States, in solidarity with the church in Puerto Rico, has been trying to make sure that there is a good, decent, humane piece of legislation that can help restructure the debt there and to provide incentives for, you know, moving forward in a way that's going to provide the jobs needed in order to make that a you know, a viable economy, to make sure that it is a good place. So I think we have Archbishop Gonzalez back on. Archbishop Gonzalez, thanks again. I'm sorry we lost you on the phone.
Yeah, for some reason there was a call failure. I'm over here in okay. Madrid visiting some seminarians from the Archdiocese of San Juan. I study here.
Okay.
I come once a year.
Well, I'm
them and to meet with the rector and formation directors and so on.
Are they they seminarians from your diocese in Puerto Rico?
Yes, yes.
Good.
I'm back here in Madrid. So hopefully we won't get cut again.
Okay. But so you know, I know there is a piece of legislation, and there's looking from your perspective, what type of help is needed in order to kind of put things in a better course to alleviate some of the problems that you've just articulated?
Yeah. Well, I'm obviously in not an expert in financial matters or economic matters, but from what I've learned from experts who've advised us, especially the team of workers led by Erica Conte at Jubilee USA, who has helped other countries that have experienced these times of crises. Puerto Rico needs the ability to restructure its debt in order to declare bankruptcy, restructure its debt, and to begin to develop new economic efforts to allow the island to begin to produce again, produce employment, and produce a better quality of life for the population. And given, as you were saying at the beginning of the program, Puerto Rico's unique political status, it's unique, rather, colonial status, because as a result of 1898, when the United States entered Puerto Rico, the military, the Navy entered and took possession of the island, the United States Supreme Court declared in some of what are called the insular cases during the beginning of the last century that Puerto Rico belongs to, but is not part of, the United States. And politically, that translates into an inadequate political system to allow Puerto Rico to make certain decisions that affect the island. And this kind of decision has to be made by Congress. And so at this point, Puerto Rico's government had actually legislated a bankruptcy law, but it was invalidated by in the U.S.
Yeah.
So, which means that Puerto Rico needs legislation from Washington, and the kind of legislation which is being introduced at the present time in Washington isn't perfect, but it will allow Puerto Rico to declare bankruptcy and begin to restructure the debt and begin to create economic development. So I believe it's something that we need to live with in order to begin to alleviate the island.
So it's almost like it might not be great progress, but at least it keeps treading water until something better can come along.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
What it just
Puerto Rico is very controversial, but
yeah,
I think it's the lesser evil that we need
When people talk about kind of economic development, which means certain businesses, jobs, etc., what do people think are the possibilities or potential businesses that could grow up in Puerto Rico that would drive that kind of economic growth?
A fair amount is talked about agriculture.
Okay.
Not sufficient attention has been paid to agricultural development.
Okay.
Puerto Rico is situated in the Caribbean. It's a beautiful place for vacation, and the tourist industry can be further developed.
Okay.
The pharmaceutical industry, with certain benefits, it could begin to create new opportunities in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Puerto Rico can also offer professional services to other islands in the Caribbean. Auditing, for example.
Okay.
There's a great number of auditors in Puerto Rico, and some of the islands in the lesser Antilles need that kind of assistance. So there's a number of ways in which Puerto Rico can further develop economically and also offer service not only to the people of Puerto Rico, but to people in neighboring islands in the Caribbean.
Well, Archbishop Gonzalez, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to be with us. But more importantly, I think this is a precise example where the voice of the church, and your voice in particular, is very, very critical in trying to deal with a difficult situation, introduce the ideas of justice, the ideas of fairness, the dignity of the person. And, you know, whenever one does that, there's always sometimes the accusation, oh, the church is meddling in politics. Why are they getting involved in politics? But basically, it's the response of our moral values saying that, hey, this is what people need to live their lives in dignity. So, you know, I want to thank you for your raising your voice and the leadership that you've given in Puerto Rico to our Christian faith, the values for many years now. So, Archbishop Gonzalez, thank you for what you're doing.
Well, I'm grateful for your words, and likewise, let me thank you for letting me speak to you and your program to these issues and these values, which are important for the universal church. Great. The social teaching of the church can make a big difference in the quality of life for peoples in many different places throughout the world.
Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome.
Okay. Archbishop Roberto Gonzalez, the Archbishop of San Juan, Puerto Rico, has been our guest here on Just Love. You know, it is very kind of difficult sometimes when we deal with situations like this because it's hard to figure out what the right answer is. I mean, as we discussed on this show, one of the things that was detrimental in causing the economy to Puerto Rico to decline was a lifting of some tax breaks and tax incentives. And, you know, sometimes when people argue on the other side of the fence, they say, hey, why are we giving all these tax incentives to big businesses? Aren't they making enough profit anyway? Why should we give them incentives? So wouldn't have surprised me if some people had, put forth the argument, hey, let's get rid of those tax incentives to those companies because we need the tax revenues to do something else. Well, and maybe that's certainly it's an argument. And then what happens is people don't have jobs because the company decides that it's no longer so profitable. Now, maybe you might argue, well, the company wasn't right. They should have taken less profits. But, you know, there's a lot of things. And so when we talk about social justice, you're always trying to kind of balance different rights. And you do live in the real world of what incentivizes people to act in a certain way. And sometimes those actions are the ones that produce greater justice or lesser justice. So it's not always all that easy to decide what very clearly what is the correct public policy that's going to create more justice and create a fairer world. That sometimes you just kind of got to argue it out and you got to figure it out. And you got to be always willing to make adjustments when that happens. And, you know, I think for our listeners, one simple thing to keep in mind, and I think this is a pretty good guideline, is when we talk about the church getting involved in the public square, and we say the church shouldn't engage in partisan politics. I mean, I have an opinion on this, and I think I'm not an outlier. This is pretty mainstream. I don't think it's appropriate for churches and church leaders to endorse specific candidates. I think you have to vote, you should vote, and you vote for whom you want. But in terms of taking a public position, I don't think that church leaders and the church should take a position on a particular candidate. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't talk about policies. And I think, again, I think we should always talk about values, we should talk about policies. When it comes to legislation There may be a time when we say, yes, this piece of legislation we're going to support. It may not be perfect, but we like it. Or this one is really bad and we want to oppose it. And I don't consider that to be partisan. It does get a little bit closer to being sometimes controversial, and it's not always certain what the answers are. Hey, thanks for being with us on Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. We'll create a world that's more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel. Thanks for being with us on Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.